this works for me if it works for everyone in the room. Can you hear me at the back? Good. I should have tried this little cursor out before starting here to learn how to use it. I might need a little rundown here. What button am I pushing?
Lift the right button.
There we go. Perfect. Thank you very much for the warm introduction and for inviting us here today to speak a little bit about Community Care Health and Care Network's hospice services. We love the opportunity to get in front of a group of people who are willing to take a little bit of time to learn about what it is we do and hopefully walk away knowing something that you didn't know before you came in here today and hopefully become aware of something that might be a valuable resource to you or someone that you know in your closer circles at some point along the line. So if you leave today without knowing something a little bit more than when you walked in, then perhaps we failed you, but I hope to bridge that gap for sure. So today, like I said, we're going to take, let me just confirm how much time we have. 45 minutes or so, is that right? Yep, okay. So really hoping that you leave this room with a better understanding of what is palliative care and what is grief. And I can guarantee that you're walking in with a preconceived sort of notion of what those things mean. And then once we take a little bit of time to work through that, I certainly would hope that you understand what it is that Community Care's hospice services can offer should you find yourself in a point in your life where palliative care would be of benefit or grief support. And then last but not least, I would hope that you leave knowing when and how to get a hold of us for when that time comes, and hopefully that time's not anytime soon, but Those are my goals here today. If there's anything else that I don't cover or Lori doesn't cover through our talk here today, then please don't hesitate to ask throughout the presentation or afterwards. I would love to have the opportunity to answer any questions that I can answer or Lori can answer. And if I don't have the answers or Lori does not have the answers, we will do our best to get those answers to you. So I have been managing hospice services for about 3.5 years, and I came over, I worked for Community Care prior to that, which is the organization I still work for. It's sort of our umbrella organization. And lots of people who know that I went from a focus as a health promoter on improving quality of life to my work at hospice, when I first started, they kind of looked at me like, You're where now? And to me, this quote helps to connect the dots for what ultimately led me personally into the world of hospice services. And Dame Cicely Saunders is one of the people who, she's a nurse, a physician, she's an activist, and was part of the initial movement for what is palliative care and hospice services worldwide. And she says, you matter because you are you, and you matter to the end of your life. And to me, this quote it speaks to the hospice world because throughout our lives, you know, if I go to the complete opposite spectrum of life and go to, you know, prenatal care and all of the supports and care that's available at that point, it's an incredible degree of support. And hospice services and palliative care advocates are trying to bring that same level of support to a different point in our life, and that's the I'll call it the closing chapter, if you will. And so going from this transition of being Community Care's health promoter to manager of hospice, my focus has remained exactly the same in that as a health promoter, I was looking at improving people's quality of life. And as hospice services, manager of hospice services, the same holds true. It's just at a very specific window in someone's life. So I find it helpful to get a sense of what is in the room in terms of understanding what is palliative care and what does that mean to you. And I don't know, there's probably roughly 80 to 90 people here today. My guess is you each have your own definition of or understanding perspective of what palliative care is. So if you could entertain me for a moment and help me understand where's the level of understanding of palliative care in the room. What does that mean to you? Care for people that are dying? Absolutely. Say that again, sorry. Relief pain? Definitely, absolutely. Provide support? What does support that word mean in your eyes? Perfect. Absolutely. Definitely. Well, I think my presentation's done. all of those things are palliative care, and I would argue that it's so much more than all of those things as well. So I'm hoping to expand your mind and expand your understanding of what that looks like, why it's important, and what we're talking about when it comes to palliative care. Something that I didn't hear that will come up through the presentation is, you know, it's a unit at the hospital. Some people understand palliative care as that, or it's, you know, the last days of life. That, you know, that's when you need palliative care, which, again, it is all those things, but it's so much more. So bear with me, and we'll work through what I understand, or what the hospice world understands palliative care to be. I have not enough handouts. But if maybe every other person takes one and you share with your neighbor, there's a handout here that I've drawn a few points from for the purpose of the presentation, because we don't have enough time to go through it all. But this handout that's circulating is from the CHPCA, Canadian Hospice Palliative Care Association. And what they have conveniently done for us, and if we go every other person, then our friends in the back will also get one. I should have asked for numbers when we were in contact through email before. My apologies. What they've conveniently done for us is put together a list of top 10 myths around palliative care. And this list is something that, honestly, we interact with every day when we have people call us, or we're out speaking in the community, and they give us their understanding of what palliative care is. And oftentimes they're absolutely right, but it's not the only piece involved in what the palliative care approach means. So for the purposes of today, what I've done is dwindled this list down to three, for the sake of time, three myths that we often see when we're working in our world here in the city of Kawartha Lakes. And I hope to bring to life kind of the meaning behind this myth-busting sheet, if you will. So it was not a plant in the audience, but there is a myth about palliative care being about only pain control. So when the gentleman said that palliative care is about pain control, I could not agree more that palliative care is about pain control. But it is not only about pain control. And I think this is a piece that hospice does particularly well, is look at all of the other facets of health. So by that, I mean we're looking at our social health, our mental health, our spiritual health, what practical support is needed. When you mentioned the support for caregivers involved in the care of someone, those are the pieces that kind of round out what we're looking at when we talk about a palliative approach to care. If we were focused only on someone's pain, which often is priority number one, and I don't discount that, because it's there should be no need for pain if we have things well managed. If we're only looking at that, we're neglecting a lot of other pieces that could factor into improving that individual's quality of life at the end of life. So I'd like to use a couple examples to speak to that jargon that I just said. One example is, at hospice we have a supportive care counselor. Our supportive care counselor in the community, you may know him, Brian Farmer. He helps people in a way that really doesn't impact pain control at all. He's looking at the realities of supporting families, for example, who are coping with just being diagnosed with a terminal illness. And for many families, that is earth-shattering. For many, it's the first time that they've had to bear the emotions that come along with that reality of, wow, my window on life has just been defined for me. And that can create a whole bunch of things. Sometimes that looks like family members who are disagreeing on certain aspects of care, and the family dynamics become a little bit out of control. And someone like our supportive care counselor, Brian, can help counsel through all of that type of thing. So it's often very helpful to have a complete stranger and outsider voice help someone work through that in a way that's supportive, because they've never had to work through that reality before. So that's one example of palliative care being definitely more than just pain control. Another example I'll use is, and this happened about 2 years ago, and we have permission from the family to share this. We don't go out sharing information about people's personal health ever unless we have their permission. But in this case, we had a woman. The woman's name was Barb, and her daughter was set to be married in the months to come. It was actually, we were sitting in about October, and the daughter's wedding was set for June. All expenses had been paid, the wedding was set, and doctors told Barb, mum, that unfortunately, Barb, it's looking like you are not going to live to see daughter's wedding. Mum and daughter have a history that, you know, you wouldn't wish upon your worst enemy. It was an up and down roller coaster ride for this family, and the two of them were together through that journey. And it was very important for Mum to be part of that day on both ends of the equation, on Mum's, from Mum's perspective and from daughter's perspective. Unfortunately, they were financially committed to the day happening, you know, 6 months down the road in June, and they weren't in a position to say, okay, well, let's just bump things ahead and we'll cancel the booking here and put it up a few months. And we had a volunteer who, much like Lori, was regularly going into the home, and she understood the importance of having Mum at this wedding and the reality that Mum likely isn't going to make the wedding. So she brought it to our hospice program coordinator, who brought it to me and said, so Ryan, here's the situation. What do you think about hosting a wedding here at hospice? And I was relatively new on the job at the time, and I thought, is this what we do? it's the only wedding that we've hosted, but we ended up hosting a Celtic hand fastening ceremony. It wasn't a legal marriage by any stretch, but we had immediate family come for this ceremony, which was on a Saturday. We had volunteers stepping up to say, I will do hair, I will do nails, I'm a professional photographer on the side, and I would be happy to take some photos. And our volunteer, who was in the home providing weekly support, led this Celtic hand fastening ceremony where daughter was wearing her wedding dress, son-in-law, or now son-in-law, was done up in his suit, and the event was pulled off without any hitches. And it was just, with a little bit of elbow grease, we supported this family in a way that was so not a
last 24 hours of life. For some, end of life might mean the last couple weeks of life. Or for some, end of life might be, you know, I've been diagnosed and I've been given a specific window on life. So so it's important to understand kind of what is palliative care with that context. Because it is all of those things. But if we limit ourselves to understanding palliative care in those last days or even weeks of life.
Are we better now? There we go. Good. If we understand palliative care as only those last days or weeks of life, we're potentially missing out on a tremendous amount of support and care that is available to you or the person who is requiring it. So by that I mean, once someone has been given a diagnosis that is progressive and ultimately going to take their life, that is a good time to start questioning when palliative care can start to be involved in the approach to someone's care. And us as a team at hospice, we have the mandate to support people early in their trajectory with disease, in their journey with disease. And all of the research suggests that that early connection to support, and when your family doctor starts to open up their understanding of palliative care and support that journey, the journey is a better experience for the family, and ultimately that results in better care, better outcomes. Not that we're changing the fact that the person will ultimately die from their illness, but the experience from today until that point can have greater quality. And that's the focus of ours. Ultimately, from day one, our decisions and our care plans are driven by what's important to you. And not that we can create miracles, but if we understand what's important to the person who we're caring for, then we can have an influence on trying to make that a reality. And the sooner we know that, the better. Oftentimes, when someone is diagnosed with an illness, they're plodding along with, I'll just say, their diagnosis of lung cancer for argument's sake. And with disease comes sharp right and left turns, and things can change on a dime. And so when there's a crisis that comes up and someone takes a quick downward spiral that ends them in the hospital, oftentimes that can be when service and additional support is initiated. We're trying to get ahead of that so that we can sort of project and anticipate what downward sharp spirals are around the corner and get ahead of those so that they don't happen. We don't guarantee that every time. It's not a perfect science, but connecting with supports earlier on is what we hope for. And we've started to shift that in the recent 5 years as we've got funding for a different part of our team, and we're starting to shift that with family docs locally, and it's all in the mindset of what Dame Cicely Saunders said in terms of having a better quality journey at the end of life. So the takeaway piece from this particular myth is expand our understanding of what end of life means. It's not just those final days or weeks. We have plenty of people on our caseload who have been being supported by us for 6 months, 9 months, over 12 months. So that's something that I'm hoping you're leaving with today. Talking about dying, myth number three. Talking about dying causes stress for my loved one. So this, I agree and disagree with this myth, because talking about dying can be a stressful conversation, but not talking about dying can be an even more stressful conversation. So we often talk at hospice and encourage families to have conversations, what we call, around advanced care planning. And advanced care planning often will surround conversations about when you can't make a decision for yourself because of the progression of disease or something has happened where you're not in a position to communicate that, your substitute decision maker will be making it on your behalf. And everyone in this room, myself included, everyone in the country has a substitute decision maker by a certain hierarchy, unless you've appointed someone outside of what that hierarchy is. Often someone will choose their spouse. There's cases where the spouse, the person doesn't feel that the spouse is the most appropriate person because, you know, for whatever reason, I won't get into that, and they appoint someone else, a power of attorney for personal care. But we at hospice try to encourage families to have conversations around advanced care planning because oftentimes there are decisions that are being made that are extremely stressful for the family because they have to be made in an instant and you're not able to communicate with your loved one in a way that helps to inform the decision. So it's important to have had that prior to in order to know that you are carrying out the wishes of your loved one. I'll use a personal example, and this is very personal for me. My mother just died on December 6th, 61 years old. And fortunately, I work where I do, and know the importance of some of what I'm here speaking about today. And I connected Mum, though she didn't have the same understanding of palliative care, I connected her early, speaking to point number two that I made. But we had really in-depth conversations about advanced care planning. December 5th is a day that we were supposed to be going into Princess Margaret to start her radiation therapy. December 5th did not get pulled off the way that December 5th was supposed to. We woke up, our mom woke up that day staying at the Cancer Lodge downtown Toronto, and really she didn't wake up. There was a hemorrhage and some of the tumors in her head, and long story short, my dad, my brother, and I were left driving from Toronto General to Toronto Western, receiving a call from the neurosurgeon on the way saying, are we doing brain surgery or not? I need to know now. Every second we wait causes more and more brain damage, and I need to know. Am I ever glad that I knew the importance of advanced care planning and gently twisted my parents' arms to dig into that conversation prior to that day so that we knew that we were making decisions based on Mum's values, wishes, and beliefs. And the decisions that we made definitely aligned with what Mum wanted. We opted not to have the surgery, hardest 20-minute period of my life, hands down, but I'm confident in the decision that we made is based on what Mum wanted us to do if that circumstance arose. Many families never have that come, but I can tell you there's times when it takes a quick right turn. And had we not had the conversation, it would be way more stressful than having had the conversation. And that was not an easy conversation to have. My mom didn't want to have it. So it's, yes, there's some stress there, but it can alleviate future stress. So that's three of the top 10 on your list. How about that for a transition out of that? But we see this all the time, and that's why I wanted to bring it forward here today to help you understand the types of things that we're talking about when we're interacting with families. And sometimes the greatest barrier to that I'll probably speak to in a minute, is people not coming on to our service soon enough, and they're already in some level of crisis. And when crisis happens, a pain crisis, for example, people aren't thinking clearly, and you're being really reactive as opposed to proactively planning the best journey possible. So I'm going to flip over to grief from palliative care, because at hospice we do one of two things, palliative care and support through grief. So again, I'd love to understand where we are in the room when it comes to grief. What does grief mean to you?
Loneliness?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Journey of healing?
Couldn't agree more. It is those things and many more things as well. So it's the internal thoughts and feelings that we have when someone dies. Grief is a natural response to loss. Now, that loss could be a marital breakup or something to that effect. In hospice's case, the loss is resulting from a death of a loved one. And it's natural. It is how our body responds to loss. It cannot be cured. We can work through that journey, as was mentioned, but it is a natural response to loss. And everyone sees grief differently and interacts with grief differently. You could experience the same loss of a mother, for example, and grieve in very different ways than people in your life. And it can manifest itself very differently. Some people get headaches or inability to focus, irritability, all of those things. It's very different for every person. And we want it often to look like the line on the left. You know, we experience a loss and I'm just going to go on this nice pleasant journey with grief over to the right-hand side, when in actual fact, it can be this windy road that is complicated, and you're walking through the grocery store after, you know, months after a significant death, and you look at a package of spaghetti and there's a wave of grief that overcomes you. So with that, we know that some people can benefit from support through that grief. Not everyone needs it, not everyone wants it, but it's something that we do, and we support hundreds of people each year in it. So I'm going to shift quickly to what it is hospice does, how we support people, our available services. I don't want you to get bogged down on some of the nitty-gritty that I'm going to dive into, because really the message that I want you to leave here today with is, if you're living, or someone in your networks is living with a terminal illness or grieving, we have supports available. That's number one message I want you to leave with. And I'll get into the different types of supports here. Before I get there, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that just our connection, because the healthcare system is such a wonderful world that often it's a little bit more complicated than it needs to be. So most people, when they think of Community Care Health and Care Network, which has been in the community since 1985, they're thinking of our community support services. They're thinking of our Meals on Wheels programs, our transportation programs, our diners clubs, things along that nature. That is the organization I work for. It's just a different part of the organization. In 2009, we added some more clinical services. We added a community health center up on in the same building as the health unit, 108 Angeline Street, which is a model of primary health care. People go there for their doctor. We added a dental clinic in 2011. We integrated with Hospice Services, which is a previous standalone organization. Now we're integrated with Community Care Health and Care Network, and then our Geriatrica team, or our GAIN team, more recently. So that's just an overview that it's my attempt to help people understand who we are and what we do, and that Community Care Health and Care Network has many different facets, many different offices in Lindsay and Fenland Falls and Bob Kitchen. But here I'm here to speak about hospice services, and we are what you would call a visiting hospice. I was speaking to, I'm going to call you Mr. Eaton, because that's, I know you as my former teacher. I was speaking to Mr. Eaton earlier, and he asked, so where in Lindsay or the city of Cortha Lakes is your facility where there's beds? And let me tell you, I would love and can't wait for the day that we have beds to offer in an independent facility for people to come to die. We do not have that in the city of Cortha Lakes. The closest, what I'd call a hospice residence to us, is in Peterborough. They just opened their 10-bed unit, which is an independent freestanding hospice residence, back in April of 2019. We want to get there. There are many different barriers to getting there. There's some funding, but not full funding. But where we support people is, we do have our facility, if you will, our building where we run different groups and do different meetings. I walked here. It's right across the road from the Academy Theater on the corner of Lindsay Street and Kent Street. But a lot of our support is provided in people's homes. So we're going out to Burnt River. We're going out to Bob Cajun. We're going out to Manila. All across City of Cortha Lakes, we're supporting people in their homes, which ultimately, for many, is where they want to receive care. That's where they're most comfortable. The majority of Canadians want to die in their home. Unfortunately, that's not the reality right now. We don't across the country don't have the same level of resources all the time that are sometimes necessary to allow that to happen. But we support people in their home through a visiting hospice. And we do that with a small staff team, within hospice services. I manage a team of 7, so there's 8 with me, and not all of those are full-time employees. And we could not do what we do without a large contingent of volunteers, which Lori is going to speak to in a couple minutes. We have over 100 volunteers who help us do what we do. And they do that all around City of Corth Lakes. We don't just need volunteers here in Lindsay. We need them down in Bethany and up in Burnt River, because in the absence of having volunteers in those areas or willing to drive to those areas, sometimes we can't provide support in those areas. So they're helping people both on providing support for the person who's living with illness, as well as perhaps some respite for the loved one who just wants to go out and have coffee with their social network, or go out and do yoga, or go do groceries, or go out for a game of golf, whatever gives them a break. Our volunteers play a big factor in allowing that to happen, as well as bringing some quality of life in the relationships that are formed and the activities that are done. We have what you call a palliative care community team. Again, don't necessarily need to get bogged down on the name here, but within that team, we have the supportive care counselor, who I mentioned earlier, and what we call our clinical nurse navigators. And those clinical nurse navigators get involved early in your care, and they are a continuous support until someone dies and beyond. There will be many other people in the healthcare system who come and go in your care, but they are a consistent, steady person who can help to answer questions, provide linkages to our on-call physician team, who is there 24/7, 24/7, 365 days a year. For someone who is in a pain crisis, we mentioned pain earlier, and has run out of medication, or the medication just isn't quite doing enough, and it's 4:30 on Friday, I challenge you to try and get a hold of your physician. And I don't know if there's any former physicians or current physicians in the room, but and the reality for someone who's living in that situation is to wait till Monday when the office opens isn't an option. So you're, in the absence of having our team involved, sometimes you're faced with, okay, I've got to go to the ER and get this looking after, whereas every one of our clients has a direct phone number for a group of physicians, local physicians, who are on call to our team. So I'm just going to carry along here. I've talked about our grief guides. That's our grief support volunteers, who are running a variety of different one-on-one meetings with people who are grieving, as well as a variety of different grief support programs. There's programs for children. There's programs for all ages. And there's some specialized programs for specific types of loss. And by that, for example, I mean a healing after suicide group, which Lori is actually one of the facilitators for, which we feel at hospice warrants its own approach and its own group, because it's different. It's a different set of circumstances than someone dying, for example, after a long, drawn-out battle with cancer. There's a different set of dynamics, and unfortunately, it's a group we need in this community. It's a group that is, on a monthly basis, full, but we're glad to be there to support people on that journey, because among many types of losses, this is one that is definitely lonely or isolating. So with that, I'm going to, looking at our time here, and I'm going to introduce Lori Tamlin, who is a volunteer for Community Care Hospice Services, has done a number of different roles and works in a number of different roles, and she's going to give you a perspective that I can't offer. She volunteers her time on a regular basis to provide care and support for people, and chooses to do that, and we're thankful for Lori and many people like Lori, because we literally could not do many of the things we do without people like her. So Lori is going to take you down in a road to help you understand what care looks like, what's the impact on her as a volunteer, and as well on the people that we support. Welcome, Lori.
morning. I hope I can use this effectively. I'm just struck by how I sit here today, having just lost my father on December 16th. And so I'm about going through the journey of grief and loss myself, as is Ryan. So I'm just struck by the power of that. And how grateful I am that I have had the experience of being with hospice, because I was able to companion my dad in a way that was very healing for both of us. And I would never have been able to do that had I not had the training that I've had in the last 3 years. So I came to, so I will give you a window into my experience. It's just one volunteer's experience, so I mean there are many. So you will have some idea of what it does look like on the inside. I came here 4 years ago from Toronto, and my previous life, professional life, was in addictions treatment and prevention. So I worked with people who were struggling with an addiction and families as well on the road to recovery. And one of the things that was very important in that was support groups. So I had a really profound awareness already of how important support was for recovery from an addiction. So when I came here thinking I was going to retire, I realized that I needed things to do, and I had this skill set, and somebody suggested that I try hospice. And again, I can't tell you how grateful I am that I made that decision. So I took the core training first, and then I took the bereavement training. They're two different trainings. And I was given, my first assignment or role was to be in a cancer support group, people who had been diagnosed with cancer, to sit with them on a monthly basis in a support group. And I had had my own experience with cancer 15 years before, so that was a really good fit for me. It was very easy for me to sit with these people who were struggling with decisions, with fear, with confusion, as to how to journey this path of being told that you have cancer. And so that was actually very, I wouldn't say easy, but very comfortable for me to do. However, then there became the next opportunity, which was to co-facilitate the healing through suicide loss. And I have not had that experience. I haven't lost a loved one to suicide, but I had had clients in my work life commit suicide. We don't use that term, commit. Sorry, that was a mistake. Complete suicide. I'd had that experience. So I said yes, and I was very nervous to be part of this group. However, it has become and is the most profound work that I've done and learning that I've taken away. These people meet twice a month. You can only imagine how devastating it is to have a son, a daughter, a mother, a husband take their own life. So the grief and loss is raw. It's so raw for these people, and they feel very disconnected from support. Most of us in our world don't know we don't know what to say to these people. We don't know how to ask them. We kind of like to avoid them, and that's exactly what happens. They're kind of isolated. People don't talk to them. So it's really important that they be together with others that understand exactly what they're going through. I have watched people transform in this group. You're never the same after that happens to you. But they become different people. They become, they have a depth of understanding and compassion that goes further than we can imagine. And they go out into the community then, and there's a ripple effect, because then they go out into the community with that new awareness of how important it is to understand when someone is going through a devastating loss. So I am so grateful to be part of that group. It's called companioning. It's not counseling. And I was a counselor, so that was a big kind of bridge that I had to make. Counseling is different than companioning. Companioning was creating a safe space for these people to come together to support each other. And that requires you to be, just to be present, to understand how to listen, and to be okay when your in an environment where there's an awful lot of pain. And so myself and another woman co-facilitate that, and we have had great success in being able to offer that for people. The other part of my role, I was also very reluctant to begin because I was companioning my dad through this period in his life. I was reluctant to take on a one-on-one client in the community who was diagnosed with a terminal illness. So what happened for me was hospice started to offer Reiki treatments. I don't know if anybody knows what that is, but it is a healing art. It's actually, in the simplest term, it's healing touch. So I'm a Reiki master, so I stepped forward and said I'd love to do those treatments for people at hospice. There was a gentleman in the community that wanted the Reiki services, but he was unable to get there. So I said I would be happy to go out and give him Reiki treatments in his home. And that's how that started. So I went to his home for at least 3 months, once a week. We did the Reiki treatment, but it turned into more of a companioning role after that. We would talk. We would sit in the same room. And in 3 months, I created a safe place for him where he started to be able to talk about his struggle with knowing that he was going to die. And all the regrets that he had, all the pain that he was carrying, it was a gift. He also wanted to know all about me, so I would talk to him about my life, and we became very bonded in that experience. And then he eventually made the decision to have medical-assisted death, so I was part of that discussion with him. So, I mean, I'm still grieving the loss of him. He's gone. He did complete it, and he had a very peaceful death. And again, that experience of watching that happen and knowing that's possible was really important in my life going forward with my dad. So those are two experiences. There are many others that people have. Those are my two right now. And again, I've gained far more than I've given. I had the joyous experience of late to be present to the birth of my first grandchild, which maybe some of you have had that experience and how wonderful that is. And I was struck by how when we come into this life, we come in crying and we're surrounded by people in joy. But when we leave this life and we take our last breath, we are surrounded with people crying, but we are in joy. And I believe that today. I believe that hospice has the opportunity and the services and the expertise to help people have peaceful, loving death. And I think we talk a lot about death. And people say to me, well, how could you volunteer somewhere, you know, in your retirement and be around grief and loss and death? Isn't that depressing? And it's quite the opposite. It's quite the opposite. I feel so privileged. I feel so nurtured. I feel so full when I leave there. And I'm so grateful for what I've learned at hospice. And I truly believe we can all have a peaceful, loving death. Thanks.
And that's why I asked Lori to join me today. So thank you so much, Lori, for sharing giving the group a little bit of a window into what it looks like down on the front line. A couple of things I just want to pick up on from what Lori mentioned. Someone earlier alluded to the fact that it must be so difficult to work at hospice on a daily basis. And I said, yes, there are times when it's difficult, but the reward that we feel in being part of someone's journey at one of the most vulnerable parts of their life is incredible. And until you do it, it's hard to understand. So I think you touched on that point. And the other piece I'll just mention quickly, because I know there's some misunderstandings about it as well, is the medical assistance in dying piece. So just for the room to understand where hospice sits on that I'll say controversial topic, because there's probably some people in this room, if I was a betting person, that are uncomfortable with that notion. We are not for or against it. We are pro-client, whatever the person wants. And we don't have an active role in facilitating what we call MAID, medical assistance in dying, but we support people as we do until the end of their life. And if they choose that, we will continue our support while they pursue that through other means. So that's just, I thought I'd clarify that, but that is a reality of where our world is, for sure. So, with my last 2 minutes, who can make a referral? You today could walk up the street, pick up your phone and make a referral, or pick up the phone and make a referral to hospice. Sometimes we get that referral from the hospital, sometimes it's from a family doctor, but anyone can refer. What's important is that if you are referring, and it's for someone else or whoever it's for, that there's consent and buy-in for that referral. You can't call for a neighbor who you know is grieving and say, can you reach out to Tom, because I know Tom's grieving, even though Tom doesn't know that that connection has been made. So that's an important piece. But there's no limitation as to who can refer. Important to note how we're funded. We receive the majority of our funding essentially from the Ministry of Health, but we are required to do some fundraising to complete our budget. So we're grateful to live in a generous community. We have different donors on a monthly basis and different events to help bridge that funding gap. And with that said, I'm not above a shameless plug, so forgive me for this one. But at the end of the month, we have Handbags for Hospice, which isn't necessarily an event geared for this room, but if you have the women in your life, because it tends to be a room filled with women, it's an event that sees 200 to 250 women come out and have a good evening. It's a Friday night where there's friendship, fellowship, and fundraising, and it's always a hit. In our first 4 years of the event, we've raised over $140,000 for hospice, and we're hoping to continue that. So handbagsforhospice2020.ca. And we have our Hike for Hospice on May 3rd, which is an annual event. Again, that tends to be people who have used our services, who are coming back in honor of a loved one, hiking in their memory. So our key messages before I leave you today and open it up for any questions is that certainly hospice supports people of all ages, of all different illness types, providing it's a progressive life-limiting illness. We have a variety of different ages who we support through the grieving journey. And we want to connect people with people early in their diagnosis with illness. The earlier, the better the outcomes tend to be in terms of the quality of that journey. And finally, we support people in their homes across the city of Cort Lake, so we don't have that residence today. One day we do want it. We have plans and a vision for it, but it's just not, hasn't come to fruition, unfortunately. So we are traveling out into the community. The last one, which is not on the list and should have been on my shameless plugs slide, is a shameless plug for volunteer opportunities. So as we've mentioned and as Lori is evidence of, we could not do what we do without support of our community through volunteers. They provide over 10,000 hours annually as a collective group, and it's incredible the work that they do for us, so thank you to that cohort. The prerequisites to become a volunteer is you don't need to be an addiction counselor, although we have the benefit of having Lori with that background. You need to be a caring and compassionate individual, and we have hours and hours of training that will bring you up to speed with the rest. So if you are a caring person, chances are you'd be a good fit with hospice, because there's different types of people and different personalities that we're looking to support. And it is a little bit of a matching game to make sure that there's an appropriate fit. So here is how you would get a hold of hospice, and I'll leave that up and just say thank you once again to the organizers of the meeting. Yes, to the Men's Progress Club, and if there's any questions, I would be happy to answer as best as I can. Great question. So, yes and no. We have in the past received a referral for someone who has only dementia, which could be argued that that is a progressive life-limiting illness. But in the absence of some other comorbidity, we look to leave that to other supports that are available. I mentioned our geriatric team as part of community care, the Alzheimer's Society. If it's only dementia, there's better spots for care.
I do. Probably you may not want to get involved. The new facility, do you have any comments on when this sort of start? And what do you think the government how's hospice dealing with that?
Great question. And I gather you've seen the sign. The facility being referred to, I believe, is across from the hospital at the old OPP. So let's just say that's a slow-moving project, not because of us, but because it is delightful working with the government. So we got funding for part of our organization to be housed in a new building up at the old OPP grounds, and that part is primarily over here our clinical services, with the exception of hospice and with the exception of dental. The government is very specific on what they would fund us to build for, and much of what we do cannot be housed in that building unless we take on or secure funding in some other way. So there's only part of our organization moving there to start, but there is vision for the rest to get there in time. Again, funding being a big factor in that equation. In terms of timelines, we were hoping to have been there, but it is a slow process to work with the government. And by slow, I mean, I think the funding was awarded 2013. We received $7.4 million, I believe. And there is just an enormous, and I'm removed from the conversation to a large degree, it's above my pay grade, but there is an enormous amount of back and forth with the government to move this along. And as you can imagine, government changeovers don't help that cause. And though we still have the funding, I hear what you're saying in terms of some of the cuts that we're seeing across the board, not only in healthcare. You wonder how that factors into things. So I am hesitant to give you a concrete timeline here today, but we are moving along as fast as we can, working within the parameters of what the government lays out for us. That's probably the best. Anyone with experience hopefully understands there, but that's that. And just to wrap that up, part of what is part of that vision is a hospice residence, which I was speaking of. We want to bring that to our community, and it could very well be on those grounds.
Are you providing services to patients at
loss? Great question. I'm glad you asked that. So, yes, absolutely we do, in a number of ways. Typically, when someone enters the hospital, our staff-based clinical team kind of leaves the direct care to the folks at the ROS, because they're wonderfully capable to do that. There's lots of resources there. But if you've ever experienced the death of a loved one on the palliative care unit at the hospital, I'm sure someone in the room has, you may recall volunteers supporting you and your loved one on the palliative care unit. Historically, they used to wear green vests. We now wear purple vests. Those are actually hospice volunteers. They are community care, Health and Care Network volunteers who happen to work out of the hospital. We provide them, we train them, we coordinate them, we schedule them. It's our partnership with the ROS to provide, again, a heightened level of quality of life. And in a lot of cases, that is the last days or week of life, though that's not exclusively what they do. So does that answer your question? Yep. Right. That's one. So June, just for, I'm not sure how aware the room is, in June 2016, medical assistance in dying, the colloquial term for that might be assisted suicide, not that we would call it that, but became legal in Canada. And it's been interesting to watch the pendulum shift and sort of even the palliative care world grapple with what that means for palliative care. I don't think we've seen the end of sort of where that's going to be and the parameters that are put on it. But I can tell you that with regularity, that is happening in our community as well as at the hospital. So it's that public input piece. I'm sure they would love people to visit the Justice website. So, any other questions? Well, like I said, feel free to grab our information off to the side here. Over here, I've got some brochures and whatnot. We're at the corner of Kent and Lindsay Street at 2 Kent Street. Thank you very much to the Probus Club for having us, and take care.